Blog Talk Radio.
Coach people, life lessons, teach people how to succeed. And how does it ever get any better than that?
With an amazing product like Legal Shield, dreams really do come true. So start writing your success story and start offering Legal Shield today.
All right, Legal Shield. That's what I've been doing. I've been doing that for 14 and a half years. I got started in September 10th. A day in a year before 9/11 in 2000. That's about 14 and a half years. And about 15 months in, on January 2nd, 2002, I went and I fired my boss. I fired him. I said, "Boss, you're fired." He says, "You can't fire me." I said, "Why not?" He goes, "Because I'm your boss." I said, "You're fired, boss." He says, "You can't fire me." And I did this in front of like 50 other sales reps. I was selling Yellow Pages at the time, and everyone was like, "Oh, my God, what the hell's going on?" And then my boss fired me. He goes, "I can fire you." And I said, "Well, go ahead and fire me, because I already fired you." He goes, "You're fired." I said, "Thank you very much." You know, I was doing Legal Shield for about 15 and a half months, but I really got serious about Legal Shield for the previous 3 months. And within 3 months, I was able to replace my income. And I've been working Legal Shield ever since. And those of you who know me, some people call me, oh, there comes Mr. Legal Shield. Well, that's fine. Some people call me Mr. Liberal. I prefer to be called Mr. Practical Liberal. But, you know, if you, I don't care, you're conservative, Republican, you know, bipartisan, I'll support you. I'll show you how to make a lot of money and help a lot of people. That's what I like about it. I help a lot of people. And I've sold, personally, like over 2,600 memberships. Personally, in my name, my team has sold over 22,000 memberships. I've lived in Bradenton for 18 and a half years. That means I've been, took me 4 years in Bradenton before I stumbled across Legal Shield. And I could walk around Bradenton with my head high, with my head held high. And knowing that anyone who I've ever sold a membership to has only been grateful, has only thanked me. No one's ever gotten mad at me. So, with that all said, we ought to get started. Oh, if you want to get a hold of me, my number is 813-924-7994. That's 813-924-7994. You can go to my website, malletagency.com, MALLETTAGENCY.com. We're doing a seminar tonight. Yes, I'm going to get into the show, but we're doing a seminar tonight. It's free. It's open to the public. It's on. It's right off the interstate, I-75 and State Road 70. I believe that's exit 217. It's at the Holiday Inn Express. You want to get there between 7:15. 7:30 at the latest. We start promptly at 7:30. We end promptly at 8:30. I'll be there. Just sign in and say you're a guest of Mitch Mallett's and won't cost you a dime. And all questions will be answered. And they'll probably create new questions in your head, and I'll be there to answer them afterwards. I'd love to meet you tonight. Tonight. Anyway, welcome to It's Your Gavel. Oh, it's your gavel, and I'm Mitch Mallett. Remember, every gavel is a mallet, but every mallet's a gavel. It's your gavel. You have the power. You be the judge. You decide, and you call the show. Now, here's the numbers I want you to call on. There's only one line open on the 1490 line because I'm using the other lines to connect to the Blog Talk Radio Network, where we're also broadcasting live. That number is, why don't I see it in front of me here? Huh. Where is it? I will tell you in a moment what it is. It's 347, and it's usually on the screen here. That's really weird. Do-do-do-do-do. 347. If anyone knows the number, call me. Give me a call. But anyway, here's what we're going to talk about tonight, today, this morning. The AIPAC Convention, the American-Israeli Action Committee, is meeting in Washington, D.C. There's going to be about 16,000 people. There's going to be a lot of speakers, both Democrats and Republicans, and the Prime Minister of Israel, Netanyahu, will be there, and he'll be speaking. The number to call in is 347-989-0132. That's 347-989-0132. Call that number. Give us a call. Wherever you are. Yeah, it's a Brooklyn number. All right. And this is what I want to talk about today. We're going to talk about Israel, the politics, Netanyahu coming, Netanyahu, who was invited by some top Democrats to meet, and he turned them down. How about that? Let's see, we have a caller here. Anyway, give us a call. Here's the number to call us at, 347-989-0132, and you'll be on the air here on 1490 AM. All right, the Israeli Action Committee. What is that? It's called AIPAC. Some people call it the Israeli Lobby. And for generations, you know, I say that and I think, oh, my God, you know, it sounds like thousands of years. But, you know, my parents' generation, my grandparents were alive at the time. So my grandparents, my parents, myself, and I'm old enough to be a grandfather, but I'm not. But I got kids old enough to be parents, and they're not, but that's okay. They're in their 20s. So I got my kids, and then I got my potential grandkids. My brother, who's younger than me, has like 5 grandkids already, 5 of them. He did get started. He had kids before I didn't. So anyway, with that all said, you know, AIPAC and Israel has enjoyed bipartisan support. What does that mean? Both Democrats and Republicans have supported the state of Israel. Harry Truman, in 1948, it was a little controversial. Harry Truman said, no, we're doing this. And at the United Nations, Harry Truman said to our U.S. ambassador, which he appointed, or it could have been Roosevelt appointed, I don't really know. But anyway, said vote in 1948, vote for the establishment of the state of Israel. And Israel was born, and immediately the Arab League, you know, Jordan and Syria and Egypt and Iraq and Saudi Arabia and other Arab countries came in and invaded, and they said, oh, yeah, we'll put a stop to this Jewish state. We're going to drive the Jews to the beaches, and if they don't get picked up quick enough by rescue boats, we're just going to slaughter them. That 600,000 Jews at the time were in the state of Israel, and there were about as many Palestinians at the time as well. The population's grown a lot. There's now more Jews in Israel, including the West Bank and Gaza, which is not part of Israel, in my head. But there's 7 million Jews now in Israel. Some people ask, what is Zionism? What is Zionism? What is that word? What does that mean? Is that like, I hear it's racism. Well, you know, you get the Palestinians, you get the people like Hamas and that whole Arab movement trying to persuade the liberal left and the libertarian right to say, oh, Zionism is racism. It's not racism. Zionism, which I'm a card-carrying member of the Zionist movement, I've served on the national board of one of its organizations. There's like a number of Zionist organizations in the United States, you know, like Hadassah has one, the Orthodox have one, the modern Orthodox have one, the conservative movement has one, there's a couple non-religious, but they're religious, organizations have one. And the Reform Movement has one called Arza. The Conservative Movement has one called Merkaz. Merkaz means central in Hebrew. And Arza is the Reform. It's kind of like the more liberal Zionist. And I served on its national board from 1986 to 1992. There was a 3 2-year terms, just to fully disclose. And I was an American delegate to 2 World Zionist Congresses in 1987 and 1992 in Jerusalem. The Zionist movement, just give you all a little background here, was started, formally founded in 1897. If you listen to the Palestinian propaganda, they say, oh, it started in 1946 after World War II by the British working with the Jews to go and purge the Muslim population from Palestine. Why would the British want to do that? I don't think the British cared. Matter of fact, after World War I, when after World War One, the Ottoman Empire, which was like more than 1,000 years, which capital was in Turkey, and the whole Arab world was part of the Ottoman Empire. There really weren't borders. You know, Egypt kind of like knew where Egypt was, but it wasn't a formal border. It's all part of the Ottoman Empire. And back then, the population was a lot more sparse, and there were cities, you know, Damascus, Jerusalem, Cairo. There was no Haifa. There was no Tel Aviv. There was Beirut. There was, you know, Mecca. And in between, there was desert, and there was a scant population of Bedouins, which was not a very big population. They kind of roamed around in tents and did their best to survive. That was the Ottoman Empire. In Turkey, there was a lot of population. In Cairo, and there's a lot of population. But the rest, they aligned themselves with Germany. They lost World War One. The French and British came in and divided up the Middle East like spoils of war. And then created borders. They created Jordan. They created Iraq, you know, and Persia, you know, was Iran. Persia was in Iran, you know, and they just divided everything up. And really, it was a matter of what sheikh had the most power at the time. We're making you the king. This is how all these countries were born and created. Without really any reflection of the natural boundaries and where the Shiites and the Sunnis are, you know, and then they just kind of threw them together. It was this that happened after World War One that has created the stage for the chaos in the Middle East today. The Zionist movement formally started in 1897 with its founding president, Theodor Herzl, but it didn't just start let's start it today, and we'll start sending Jews, because for about 30 years prior to, Jews were moving from Eastern Europe into the Middle East. We're moving to Palestine, you know, and the Russians, the pogroms were taking place. A pogrom, what's a pogrom? If there wasn't a Holocaust in World War II, we'd all know about the pogroms a little more clearly. But upwards of 2 million Jews were killed by the Russian czars. And the Jews lived in their own villages throughout Russia. And the Tsarist army decided to go in one village at a time with its Cossacks and just kill everyone in the village. Up to 2 million people were killed. My great-grandfather, Nissan Meyer, his father's name was Meyer. When he eventually got to the United States, they said, oh, you're Meyerson. Everyone's thinking Ellis Island. It wasn't Ellis Island. I'll get to that in a moment. But my great-grandfather, Nissan, who later called himself Nathan in the United States, woke up to the screaming death of his wife being bayoneted and two of his six kids being killed. And he fought off a soldier, one soldier who did that in their sleep, fought him off and grabbed the other four kids and ran into the forest. That's my great-grandfather. He never returned to that house. He ran, and Jews were fleeing into the forest, and, you know, it's a little bit of mystery exactly what occurred, but there was a movement to get the Jews out, and they got themselves to England, and they were in England for a few months, and the Jewish community in London were supporting the Jews, pulling them out of Russia, those who were fleeing for their lives, literally. And this is before, this is the early 1890s. This is before the Zionist movement. And some of them went to Palestine because And most of them went to the United States, and my grandfather got on board a boat with four of his kids and got on a ship headed to the United States, going to Ellis Island. And Ellis Island was so overwhelmed, mainly by Russian Jewish refugees that the United States allowed in. If you're Jewish from Russian background, or you have friends who are Jewish from Russian background, and most American Jews are from Russian background. That's where I am. Little Lithuanian, little Ukrainian. It was happening all over Eastern Europe. That's how we got here. And the ship was told not to go to Ellis Island. They set up in Sag Harbor an auxiliary immigration center because Ellis Island was overrun with immigration. There were some protests, but nothing like the immigration going on here today in the United States. My great-grandfather, Nissan, those of you curious, he's the father of my grandmother, Esther, who married Murray Einstein. Yes, she married Murray Einstein. Second cousin to Albert, so they tell me. And which means he's got a great-grandfather in common with Albert, which means I got a great-great-grandfather in common with Albert's great-grandfather. My great-great-grandfather and grandmother, by the way, takes two. Who had my mother, Natalie, spelled with a T-H, N-A-T-H, because she was supposed to be a boy, but she was a girl, and they were going to name her Nathan after my great-grandfather, Nathan. But it's Natalie. She had me and my brother and my sister. But he got off that boat. Everyone's talking about, we're going to Brooklyn, and they're talking about Brooklyn and how all the Jews are there, and there are these apartment buildings, and a lot of them are freshly built, and they're five-story walk-ups, no elevators, just five-story walk-ups. And they were excited to go, and Nason looked around in Sag Harbor, and if you've ever been to the Hamptons at the end of Long Island, which is where Sag Harbor, New York is, and actually, and I've been there, and I visited there, and I visited the graves of my grandparents and my great-grandparents and about 30 other great-uncles and aunts and cousins all buried at that same cemetery. By the way, Bess Meyerson's buried there as well at the temple in Sag Harbor. My great-grandfather looked around and said, "It's beautiful here. Why not stay here?" Everybody said, Nissan, in Russian, they said, "There's no Jews here. If we stay, there'll be Jews." True story. So he stayed. A year later, they're greeting other Russian immigrants at the harbor as they were coming in, and they said, "Stay." He met my great-grandmother on one of those boats and started a second family, and I understand had seven more kids with her. That's a lot of kids he had. I got a lot of second cousins floating around. And that temple still exists in Sag Harbor, which is like the village for the Hamptons. If you ever go to the Hamptons, the village everyone goes to is Sag Harbor. It's all there, East Hampton, whatever, the Hamptons and Sag Harbor. And it's very nice place to visit. Anyway, I say this because while that was all occurring, Jews were from the 1860s, 70s, and really escalating and trickling in the 70s and in the 1880s, starting en masse in the 1890s, Jews were going to Palestine as well. They were just going. This is before the Zionist movement started. They called themselves Zionists, but the movement wasn't formulated. It was a grassroots movement. It was just like, we're doing it. We're happening. There was no structure to it. It was Theodor Herzl that put a structure to it. and created an institution that he can go around to world Jewish communities and say, the Jews going to Palestine need your help. Now, they were greeted by other Jews already in Palestine. And where did they come from? They never left. When Rome came in the year 70 and conquered Israel, I hope I have those years right, and then, you know, you hear the story of Masada and the Maccabees and all this stuff going on. I'm mixing up a couple things in history, but the Romans, not to get too deep into that, the Romans just conquered Israel. Romans, for a few hundred years, they had a peace treaty with Israel. And as each generation went by, there was trade. You know, Israel was a friendly ally of Rome, always pledged their loyalty, don't invade us, don't conquer us. Rome wanted more and more and more. And eventually there was a rebellion in Israel. And Rome went in there and slaughtered like half the Jewish population and dispersed the other 40%, and about 10% remained. You can't. The cost effectiveness of getting every last Jew out of Palestine just wasn't cost effective. It was the reality of the day. And with that small of a population, Rome had control of ancient Israel. Anyway, you know, later on, a lot of them went back to Rome. At one point, when Constantine declared Rome Christian, 30% of the population at the time was Jewish. Go look it up. It's fascinating. I could talk an hour on what happened there. But we'll just leave that be. So you got Jews who've always lived in Israel. You got Rome who conquered it. Then you had Muhammad came around in the 6th century and started Islam, violently started Islam. You know, Jesus didn't start, and his followers, Jesus died violently. His disciples started Christianity. It was more of a peaceful movement. And Jews lived there, and then Muslims converted the other populations, and, you know, and actually the population in 1860 in Palestine was small. There's debate. It could have been as little as 10,000 people. I don't think it was. I think it was more than 10,000 people, but it was certainly less than 100,000 people in 1860. I just want to put that out there. And Jews started coming to Palestine. And Jewish support, mainly from England, started pouring money into Palestine. Because the Jewish community in England started pouring money in, and there was prosperity. And then Muslims moved from the surrounding countries, from Cairo and from Damascus and from what's now Jordan and Syria and Lebanon and even Saudi Arabia, most of them from Egypt. Most of them from Egypt. So if you hear about these Arab villages, you know, that were destroyed in 1948, you know, they're now part of Israel proper. Some of them are now state parks and, you know, and the Palestinians go, oh, look, you know, that was the village of my grandfather. You got to ask, where was your grandfather's grandfather? Because if you go back another two generations, that village didn't exist. The Muslim immigrants from the other countries came and they started villages. So they give you the impression like these villages were around for hundreds and hundreds and a thousand years. Whether that's important or not is up to you to decide. But I just want to say, Zionism to me is the liberation movement of the Jewish people. And I see you on the line there, Lawrence. I'm going to get to you in just a minute. Zionism is the liberation movement of the Jewish people. I'm a strong supporter of Israel. I believe that Israel must exist and has to exist for the survivability of the Jewish people. I think it's important. If you're a Christian, let me ask you this question. If you're one of those sympathetic Christians that are sympathetic to the poor Palestinians living in Israel, I will get into it in a minute, on why things should and could be better and still coexist with Israel. It's not just Israel's fault. I'll just say this. Since 1948, when there were refugees created, and there were some more refugees created in 67, but not really, the rest of the Arab world said close their borders to these displaced people. Syria, there's now like 2 million refugees from Syria living either in Jordan or Turkey. Jordan and Turkey didn't close their borders to the Syrian refugees that are going on right now. But to the Palestinians, it's time to close. Nope, you can't come here. You stay there. We're going to resolve your issue. Well, it was never resolved. And those villages have turned into, or those what are called refugee camps, which are sometimes still referred to as refugee camps, are villages today. They're homes and shops, and people have cars, and the people in the West Bank, the Palestinians live in the West Bank, certainly have it a lot better than the Palestinians in Gaza. Because the people in the West Bank have chosen a different path. The people in Gaza are much more radicalized, and they took a lot of supplies in the UN and say, hey, we're going to pump cement in, and we want you to build hospitals and multi-story apartment buildings because the population is very dense there, and we want to better your life. And they took a lot of that concrete. While they built some of those things, they were building tunnels. They're using the money to get rockets in, mostly from Iran. They showered 20,000 rockets into Israel, 20,000 of them over the last 10 to 15 years. Certainly since 10 years, since Israel under Prime Minister Ariel Sharon, and I admire him for this, they tried to negotiate a withdrawal from Gaza for peace. We'll leave. Israel patrolled Gaza. The Israeli soldiers patrolled it. It was peaceful. The people of Gaza, many of them came to work within Israel. A lot of them worked within Gaza. And there was free flow of people going home at night to Gaza, working in Israel. And prosperity was taking hold in Gaza. But Gazans, they wanted, you know, they didn't want to be that relationship. They wanted to be their own people. And there were terrorist attacks, and there were, you know, resistance. And the Israeli soldiers, at a huge cost to Israel, were taking casualties, and both in blood and money, to keep Gaza peaceful. And Ariel Sharon, they refused to really come up with any kind of terms whatsoever. And Ariel Sharon said, fine, to a shock. The shock of the Israeli right, and Sharon is from the Israeli right. Some could argue maybe he's even right of Netanyahu, and said, we're pulling out of Gaza. It's too expensive. We're not doing this anymore. We're losing young Israeli men and women in Gaza, and it costs too much. We're just going to pull out. We're not negotiating. We're just unilaterally pulling out. And there were some settlements within Gaza. They put settlements in there, and they, Sharon said, you got to move in. And to the settlers there, it was torture. Most of them left within the timetable, and some of them stayed to the end and said, if you're going to remove me, you got to remove me. You got to pick me up out of my home and carry me out of here, which is what happened. I just want to just give you a little backdrop of what's going on, you know, to be able to just look and go, oh, Netanyahu's meeting with Congress, and he's not meeting with the president, and the president refuses to meet with him, and Netanyahu now refuses to meet with the Democrats, and which I'll get into in a minute. It's not so simple. You can't just go, oh, boom, what's this all about? You need to understand what's going on here. 20,000 rockets, you know, I've heard Henry Raines a few years ago, you know, they're like bottle rockets. He said, no, these are not like bottle rockets. And as the years have progressed, these rockets have gotten bigger and further and more explosive and further range. They can reach Jerusalem, and they can reach Tel Aviv now. And they got the markings of Iran on these rockets. In Israel, they got the Iron Dome, which they didn't have when they first started shooting these rockets. And it was Israeli engineers who took, you know, the U.S. said, here's the money. You think you can develop anti-missiles? And the Israeli scientists, they developed them. U.S.-backed money to fund it. And most of these missiles are made in the United States. And during the Gaza, Israel said enough is enough and went into Gaza and crushed. And some kind of argued that they crushed too much. You know, I got to tell you, my heart goes out to the Palestinian people. However, you're going to shoot rockets like that, and then your Hamas leadership is going to shoot these rockets from hospitals and schools. I mean, there's open ground. You can go into the fields and shoot them off. You don't have to shoot them off in populated areas. And shoot them off from tops of apartment buildings. And then Hamas will put civilians, women and children, and let the Israelis know there's a lot of women and children in there. And if the women and children try to leave, the Hamas fighters have it surrounded. And they'll shoot those who run out. And they do shoot the ones who run out. So you're basically, and my heart goes out to these people. Under Hamas leadership, this is how much they think of you. You may become a martyr. If you run out, you will become a martyr. If you stay in there, maybe you'll become a martyr. And maybe you'll survive the Israeli attack. You know, hunker down, find yourself the best protection you can. And if you survive it, you survive it. God willing, Allah willing. That's their attitude. Allah will will you to live, and Allah will decide that you're a martyr. So with all these casualties coming out of the Israeli attacks, because Israel goes in there with leaflets saying, we're taking this out, you need to leave. And Hamas fighters, that is a fact. Doesn't matter whether I'm from the right or left. Some go, oh, Mitch, man, you're from the left. How could you? I'm a practical liberal. It's practical. That's practical. That's what's going on. You need to understand the reality and deal with the reality and come up with realistic solutions. Israel can't tolerate ongoing missile strikes, and Israel got wind of these tunnels. A lot more tunnels they found than they expected. A lot more sophisticated than they expected. And had these tunnels continued to be allowed to be built, and they were being built 24 hours a day. They had the Palestinians in Gaza. They were employed by Hamas. You get a paycheck. You go in there, and you dig, and this is your shift. And 24 hours a day, because once you're underground, it doesn't matter if it's day or night. You're going to dig, and we're just going to keep building these tunnels, and we're going to reinforce them with cement that they think we're going to build hospitals and homes and schools and factories and infrastructure. We're building tunnels. Israel needed to do what they did. And, you know, every exact tactic would I agree with? Maybe not, but, you know, being a Monday morning quarterback, it's a little different than, you know, the play's about to be executed. What's the best strategy? With hindsight, could they have done some things better? Probably. But overall, I do support what Israel had to do because they had to do it. A lot of people got killed. More people got killed than needed. Israelis got killed. Israelis were getting killed from rockets. It was disrupting. Imagine where you live. Imagine here we are in Bradenton. And over there in Palmetto, across the river, now there's no river, we're from Sarasota. Well, you live in Sarasota, and we in Bradenton, we're shooting rockets into Sarasota. Now, you may be able to shoot most of them down, but, oh, another rocket. And you're running downstairs, and you got like 10 seconds to go seek shelter. How productive can your life be? How stressful can your life be? This is the southern third of Israel. About half of Israel's population was dealing with this. That needs to be said. Now, here, I'm going to go to Lawrence over here, and then because after that, then we're going to get into Netanyahu and AIPAC, and I'm going to be at the convention. And I should point out also, for full disclosure, I'm active in the Jewish Federation, the Manti Sarasota County Jewish Federation. I'm on the Israeli Advocacy Committee. There's nine of us, including the director of the Federation and one of its staff, and seven others, if I have my count right, including several Christian clergy, and a rabbi and a couple other Jewish lay people. I'm one of them. We're going as a delegation to the AIPAC convention in Washington this weekend, and I'm leaving tomorrow. Lawrence, is that you?
Yes. What time is it? Sorry.
Lawrence, you're lined
yes.
up. Maybe we got someone calling from the 727 area code. Is that you?
Well, that's me. That's me.
Live on the air.
Okay.
Maybe you're not Lawrence. He's from the 727 area code. If you want to speak live, you know, you can call the number. I'll give you the number again, and you just hit the one button. The number is 347-989-0132. That's 347-989-0132. And we have a new sponsor, and we're going to take a little commercial break. It's going to be an add-on, but I want to ask you this question. I asked this question to a group Monday night, and I recorded this, so listen to this.
Here we go. If you had your choice, and you don't, between coal or solar, and the cost of your electricity was the same, what would you choose?
Solar!
And, you know, the person who I just tried to bring on, I realized I didn't have your mic on, even though I was calling on you, but I will get back to you in a minute. So the question was, if you had your choice, and you don't, to choose where your electricity came from, would you choose coal or solar? There are some other choices, you know, there's nuclear and wind, and then maybe you choose wind, and there's oil and natural gas. But here, let's just get down to it, because we got a lot of coal here. And most of the oil plants now in Florida have been converted to natural gas, which is really cool. I will praise the electric companies, because when I got started in this show, half the electricity from Florida was produced from oil. Now it's natural gas, which is really good, because you wonder why gas has come down at the pump. One reason is it's not just in Florida, but a lot of the electricity that was produced by coal, and I will get back to you, caller, or was produced by oil is now being produced by natural gas. Therefore, the oil can now go back to gasoline or home heating oil, which drives the price down. And that's domestic gas, so that's part of it. Part of it is all the solar. But if you had your choice, which you don't, between having your electricity come from solar or coal, what would you choose? Everyone I asked has chosen solar. Why? Because it's cleaner and all this other good stuff. And the price was the same. Well, actually, you have that choice. You just don't know it. You just don't know it. Why don't you know it? Because you're a homeowner or a business owner. And if you're a condo owner and you live in a big building, you can go and have your condo converted. But you can have solar collectors put on your roof. And it can be financed. And the cost of financing that solar equipment, the monthly payment will be less than what your savings are. Hey, just call the number and I'll get to you in about 2 minutes. So, I can't hear you. So anyway, the solar will cost you less than what you're paying in your electric bill. So I'll just say, if your electric bill is $200 a month, your solar payment could be $200 a month, that'd be the same. Why not go with solar? What if it was $180 a month? What if it was $150 a month? What if it was $120 a month? What if it was $100, half? So I want you to call. Go ahead and call. And Lawrence, call the other number. I'll get right to you. I want you to call Miracell Solar, all right? And their number is 1-800-99-SOLAR. 866, rather, 99-SOLAR. That's their phone number. Call them. Tell them you heard it on the radio. Or you can go to their website, www.mirasolsolar.com. All right? Lawrence, you call my cell phone. I can't put you on the air. Call the number and I'll get to you. All right. Now we're back. We're back. And we will have an ad created for them. Very proud to bring them on as a sponsor. And here, I want to talk about Netanyahu. Because since the establishment of the State of Israel, Israel has enjoyed bipartisan support. Starting with George Bush II, W, he's sometimes called, probably had the most disastrous Middle East policy ever by any president. If anyone thinks he was good for Israel, he's left the Middle East in chaos. You know, the Republicans will try to blame Obama because the ramifications of what they did in Iraq, what we did by going into Iraq and destabilizing Iraq, you know, just because we have a new president, do you think they over there go, oh, new president? ISIS has emerged from this. I'm going to be right with you, Lawrence. I see you on the board. So, but every president has tried to be a supporter of Israel. Every president has been a supporter of Israel. Even Obama has been great to Israel. When Israel, during the Gaza thing, were running out of rockets, the Iron Dome, the president ordered, and he asked Congress to back him up on this, but he said he was going to do it anyway, ordered $350 million worth of rockets to be airlifted to Israel to continue the Iron Dome. When push came to shove in the United Nations against Israel, the United The Obama administration backed Israel 100%, where a lot of European countries didn't. You know, I'm going to get to Lawrence now, but oh, Lawrence isn't there. Lawrence, get there, and I'll call on you. Some people are saying Lawrence isn't even here. Well, if he calls, you better call now. I'll get to him. So now we got Netanyahu and the Republicans have decided, hey, we can go get the Jewish vote. We think this is a winning ticket. This will turn Israel into a wedge issue. Now, so the Republicans have gone ahead, and during these elections, they have said, hey, if you're Jewish, you should be voting for Republican because we're the pro-Israel. That's so dangerous. Because I got to tell you, because I'm active in the Democratic Party, and the Palestinians are putting this mask on, like, oh, we're the poor victims, and you should feel sorry for us. This is all funded by Hamas coming out of Israel. You should feel sorry for us. We're poor victims, and look at our villages in 48 and all this. And trying to get the sympathy vote, where the fact is, it's Hamas is a right-wing religious extremist organization that wants to impose Sharia law. So they're trying to gather the left. They're trying to gather the left and do that. Lawrence, I cannot hear you because I turned my volume off on my phone. You keep calling, call the number. I'll get to you immediately. I challenge you immediately. So they got a lot of money. They hired some very expensive PR firms, and they're making inroads in the Democratic Party. The Republicans, and you've got Netanyahu playing with the Republicans, Yeah, we're going to stick it to Obama. We're going to stick it to that black man because there's a lot of racism behind the Republican Party. And Netanyahu is a co-conspirator, and they're playing games, and they turn around and they announce Netanyahu is going to speak to a joint session of Congress because we, the Republicans, we now control both houses, and we've invited him. And there you go, Mr. President. We bypassed the State Department. It's the Republican Party that is in violation of the Constitution, practicing foreign policy, not acting as advisorship, but acting as if they are running foreign policy and inviting a foreign head of state. That has never, ever occurred before. And President Obama is, like, holding firm. You know, part of me goes, you know, with some hindsight here, because a lot of this is working. You know, their propaganda machine out there going, look, the president's snubbing Netanyahu. It's Netanyahu snubbing the president. And the president's holding ground, you know. With hindsight, I think maybe the president should have then just gone, oh, Netanyahu's coming? Listen, you're invited to the White House. Come have dinner the night before. He should have. But he said, what's this? But he knows that Israel is split, politically split right now, down the middle. They're about to have elections in about 3 weeks. Netanyahu's using this to gather popular support among Israelis, but it's missing because his tactics are split in the United States. And a lot of the Israeli population, you know, Netanyahu's base is going, yeah, go, Netanyahu, go. But the left wing of Israel is going, what are you doing? You're creating chaos here. You go, it's your gavel.
Why are you afraid to let somebody talk, Mitchell?
Lawrence, why?
Yes.
Don't call.
Yes, you're only caller. Why are you afraid to let somebody talk?
Lawrence, you either ask a question.
Okay, I'll ask a question. Has the Israeli-United States relationship ever been lower than it is now?
On the radio through my cell phone.
Is there any, is Israel, I'm asking a question, you're afraid.
Are you going to bring up a real topic?
Yes.
Then bring it up.
Is there ever been, since the inception of the country of Israel, been a relationship with the United States been lower than it is at this very moment?
And I blame Netanyahu for that.
Oh, okay. How about George Bush?
George Bush has called.
5 times you've been to Israel. You blame, but the reality, Mitch Mallett,
you're talking over.
You lackey, it's Barack Hussein Obama.
Fucking points. Give
and
me.
You ought to be embarrassed.
No, there's another. We should be embarrassed. That's right.
You should be embarrassed.
What else you got?
Shonda, you ought to be embarrassed.
I'm not embarrassed.
That's right. Never again, Mitch. No. Never again. What does that mean to you, Mitch?
These are right-wing talking points.
What does never again mean to you? You just went through the soliloquy of your family history and your insurance job. What is it that never again means?
Seats. And they said, when we run the Senate, we're going to get along with the Democrats. If we were in charge, we'd get along with the Democrats. You know what? It's even worse. It's
never again
now than it was before. And what do you say to that, Lawrence?
Barack Hussein Obama is president, Mitch, and the country's relationship with Israel is at an all-time low.
Thank you.
And you are acknowledging and giving excuses. You're an apologist for the Schwarza.
Has any congressional leadership ever stepped up and played politics with foreign relations?
How many Democrats are not going to listen to Netanyahu?
Violation of the Constitution.
How many Democrats are not going to listen to...
They are breaking the Constitution.
How many Democrats aren't going?
You do not support the Constitution, do you?
You support those Democrats not going to listen to Netanyahu?
Netanyahu came out.
Do you support those Democrats that aren't going to listen?
As they would like to meet with
you. Do you support the Democrats that are not going to listen?
A bipartisanship.
But do you support those Democrats?
Party or the other.
Do you support those Democrats?
because Netanyahu's having...
Do you support those Democrats?
Conversations continue.
Do you support those Democrats?
And Mitchell, another top...
Do you support those Democrats?
What they're going to do to...
Do you support those Democrats?
Look back.
Do you support those Democrats?
The Republicans are...
Do you support those Democrats?
Israel.
Do you support your fellow Democrats?
Less damage.
Do you support your fellow Democrats?
Israel, because...
Do you support your fellow Democrats? Do you support your fellow Democrats?
And the Republicans...
Do you support your fellow Democrats? Do you support your fellow Democrats, Mitch Mallett?
Israel.
Do you support your fellow Democrats, Mitch Mallett?
You're giving inroads, and you are...
Do you support your fellow Democrats? Do you support your fellow Democrats?
And is trying to...
Do you support your fellow Democrats?
Take advantage of it.
Do you support your fellow Democrats?
The worst thing you can do for Israel is break the bipartisan support, and that's what the Republicans are trying to do. They're trying to use Israel as a wedge, which is actually going to do more harm to Israel in the long run, Lawrence, and your ilk are responsible.
Do you support your fellow Democrats?
I support Democrats. And with this all said, Lawrence...
You're listening to 1490 AM, WWPR, Bradenton, Sarasota, Tampa Bay.
I am out of here, and I got to go, and I've been playing with the phone, and I'm not sure how that's going to go through on the Blog Talk Radio in the archive. If it looks broken up, I apologize. But I am going to do some radio shows on the Blog Talk Radio throughout the weekend. Go to It's Your Gavel. Pay attention. And we are done here.
Roman says the idea was born one day during a chat over a humble cup of tea.
As you know, we had tremendous success with that. 100 million.